I welcome you back to our 4.5 year journey, verse by verse, through the entirety of God's inspired word. Today, we are about a quarter of the way through our second year of this journey, and we're in the second book of Samuel, chapter number 9. The chronology of this section has to kind of be worked at a little bit. We don't have any clear-cut indicators. And so I'm going to give you my theory and some of the reasons for it as we begin today. I believe that we're looking at something that may have taken place in the 14th year of King David, which by my calculations is a sabbatical year. That is significant because David would not be going to war during this time period. He would not be focused on any of the agricultural business of his kingdom during this period because in a sabbatical year, everybody is supposed to take time off from their regular physical work. And that means a lot of people would take time to just reflect and think and relax in the kingdom. And I believe David got to thinking during a period such as that, I wonder if Jonathan left behind any children that have survived that I can help. And that brings us then to the actual inspired text. 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1 says, David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So David is aware that a lot of the family of Saul died in the Mount Gilboa incident, as well as the evacuation, maybe some Philistine attacks upon the family. And then, of course, we have the assassination that takes place a couple of years later, and maybe some follow-up to that. So he is hoping that someone can tell him, someone of the line of Jonathan in particular, but Saul in general, may have survived all of that. Verse 2. "Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. They called him to David." So David is thinking out loud about this. His own counselors tell him, well, maybe the best person to ask about that is the man who is still administering the estate of the late King Saul. His name is Ziba. So the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." Now, this is the young man that we are going to focus our attention on. He was 5 years old when his father Jonathan and his uncles and his grandfather Saul were killed in the Battle of Mount Gilboa. And in their haste to evacuate the capital city of Gibeah, he was dropped by his nurse, who was apparently trying to carry him rapidly out of the building. And in falling, he ended up getting his feet crushed or hurt in some fashion. So that from now on, from that point on, he had crippled feet. The bones did not set properly. So Ziba is aware that there is this young man who by now has got to be about 18, 19 years of age, maybe 20. We know that he has a son. So David is hoping that maybe this is the one that I can show kindness to. So the king said to him, "Where is he?" Because he doesn't know where he's at. Ziba said to the king, "Well, he's in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar. So he's kind of in an out-of-the-way place. He's not making a big deal out of the fact that he is the surviving member of the last dynasty, for obvious reasons, especially in the light of his uncle's assassination a few years earlier. Remember, in the Middle East at this time, it was common practice that when a new administration took over, everybody related to the last one were wiped out so that they could never challenge the change. So Ziba gives this information up. Verse 5, then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. Now let's talk about his name. I am going to call him Merib Baal, even though you see in the text here Mephibosheth, and here's my reason for it. In other passages, his given name is Merib Baal, which in a merger of Hebrew and Canaanite means the Lord is my advocate. In the time of Saul and David, the Canaanite dialect was used for some vocabulary words. Baal meant master or Lord, and so it became a common substitute for the Hebrew word Adonai, which also means Lord or master. And so they would use it when they made names. Merib, my advocate, is Baal, the Lord. And so it was a reference to the true and living God. However, a few generations later, Baal became exclusively connected to the thunder and lightning god of the pagan peoples of that part of the world. And so scribes, religious scribes, very serious religious scribes, just could not bring themselves to put the name Baal into their copy of the text and be okay with that. So they substituted a different name for these people. So they put down Mephibosheth, or Mephibosheth, which means shatter the shameful thing. So break down Baal, basically. So it's just kind of a, it's a redo of history based on the sensitivities of future generations. And I think some of us can appreciate things like that kind of happening in our modern time, where people don't want to acknowledge things of the past. They'd like them to just kind of disappear into the background. But we're not going to do that here. We are going to name his name as it was originally intended, Baal being a representation of the one true God of Israel, just meaning Lord. All right, so Merib Baal, the son of Jonathan, son of David, or son of Saul, came to David, fell on his face, and paid homage. And David said, Merib Baal. And he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always. Now, Merib Baal would probably have been very nervous to be called into David's presence at this particular point in his life, because he is, as far as we can tell, the sole surviving member of the former royal family. And so in other places of the Middle East, he could have been called in to be killed. But David tells him, no, that is not my intention here. I am here to show you the special treatment that I promised your dad I would do. From now on, you will have under your control all of your family's former property, and you will be eating at my personal table day by day, week by week, here at Jerusalem. In fact, he's going to say here in a moment that basically he's going to treat him as one of his sons, kind of adopt him into his family. Verse number 8, he paid homage, that is Merib Baal, paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" And that's a genuine question. Why? Why would you, the king, show such respect and honor to me, a crippled member of the former royal family? And the answer, of course, is because David is honoring his friend Jonathan and the commitments that he'd made to him. Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him, shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat." Now, this is where a problem is going to arise. Because up to this point, possibly for 14 years, remember, Ziba has pretty much been the guy that benefited from the former estate of the late King Saul and his sons. So he's been doing pretty well. He's got all of this property that he's supposed to be taking care of for the estate, but all of the proceeds are going to him and his family. And now he's told that's not going to happen anymore. From now on, all of the proceeds belong to Merib Baal. Continuing in the verse, "But Merib Baal, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Ziba is going to come back later in another story and cause trouble for Merib Baal. And I will refer you back to this incident as the reason why he did that is because he doesn't like the change of status that David just caused to happen. Verse 11, Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Merib Baal ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. So if I am correct that this is 14 years into David's kingdom, then he's probably got teenage sons and a few that are preteen. And a lot of the others are down like in that single-digit age range. And they come and eat at the table, and now Merib Baal is going to come in and join them and be one of the family. And not just him, he's also got his own son. Verse 12, Merib Baal had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Merib Baal's servants. And so Merib Baal lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Now, as I said, if I am correct that this is somewhere around the 14th year of David's kingdom, then Merib Baal must be about 19, maybe 20. And therefore, his son, Micah, must have been recently born in the last couple or few years. And so they're all now part of the royal household. Okay, that takes care of that part of Saul's family. Now let's maybe zoom ahead a year or so to see what happens with another branch or branches of Saul's family. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 21 now. This is in kind of appendix material that is outside of some of the other chronological things. It says, now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. Now, famine is a tough thing to have happen. But the worst timing for a famine would be in association with a sabbatical year, because you're already refraining from harvesting and planting in a sabbatical year. And so you've already been eating out of your stores from a previous year, and you don't really have a hope of having any additions to those stores until 2 years after the last harvest that you actively engaged in. So it is a horrible thing to have a three-year famine with the sabbatical year right there in the middle. So I am guessing that it may have been something like that that 2 Samuel chapter 21 is talking about. In addition, it is clear that this famine is brought on by God's judgment. Something is happening that God wants dealt with. And we know, going back to the time of Moses, that God said one of the things he would do when people were breaking the covenant is he would disrupt the rain cycle and send famines until they repented and got things right. And so what do we see? 2 Samuel chapter 21 says, David sought the face of he who is. So a three-year famine, David goes, this isn't right. There must be a problem in the land. Let's find out from God. So he asks God, probably using the Urim and the Thummim. Or perhaps he asked the prophets near him to talk to the Lord and see if they could get a vision. But somehow he gets the answer, and here it comes. He who is said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. The Gibeonites were people living near the town of Gibeon, where the tabernacle was located in the years of Saul, back in the time of Joshua. The Gibeonites were able to escape being treated like all the other Canaanites and either chased out of the country or executed, because they tricked the Israelis into thinking they were from somewhere outside the boundaries of the Promised Land. The Israelis didn't check in with God, and so they got duped, but their oath remained intact. They could not execute any of the Gibeonites. They had to incorporate them into Israeli society, which they did. They told them that they would be permanent workers for the tabernacle, which may have a reason for why Samuel relocated the second tabernacle there after the first tabernacle at Shiloh had been destroyed. So everything was going along great until Saul got it in his head that he should kill off a whole bunch of the Gibeonites. And it wasn't just him. His sons, apparently, at least some of them were involved in it, and we find out a few of his grandsons were also involved in it. And so this judgment that has brought the famine is associated with that atrocity, the failure to keep the vow made in the days of Joshua that the Gibeonites would be accepted as part of Israeli society, provided they did their job serving the tabernacle. Now, verse number 2 of 2 Samuel 21. So the king, King David, called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now, the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. Although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. So there's the brief inspired explanation of what I was just now telling you. So David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of he who is?" So he asked the Gibeonites, "What do you think we should do in order to make up for this injustice carried out against you by Saul and his family members?" The Gibeonites said to him, "It is not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house, neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." So their initial response is, "We don't have the right to demand financial remuneration, nor what we think should happen, which is execution of those that committed the atrocities. That's not our right." But David gives them that right. He said, "What do you say that I should do for you?" They said to the king, "The man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel, let seven of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before he who is at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of he who is." And the king said, "I will give them." So they want seven of Saul's male descendants, his sons, if any remained, or grandsons that had been involved in these atrocities. Now, King David makes one thing clear, and that's verse 7. "But the king spared Mephibosheth," or Meribbaal, "the son of Saul's son Jonathan, because of the oath of he who is that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul, as well as Micah, his son." So David says, Meribbaal and his son are off the list of those that can be executed because they weren't involved, obviously. And so they are spared, which is one of the reasons why this story has to come after the story we told previous to this. So the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, Armoni and another Meribbaal, and the five sons of Mereb, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, son of Barzillai, the Maholathite. And he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the mountain before he who is, and the seven of them perished together. So these are sons through secondary wives, through a secondary wife, and grandsons through a daughter of Saul. And this would be the woman that David was initially offered in marriage, Merib. Well, her boys were apparently involved in these atrocities. And so they are executed. And then according to Israeli law, their bodies are hung up on a tree afterwards. They were put to death in the first days of harvest, at the beginning of the barley harvest. So that tells us exactly what time of year it is. It's immediately after Passover of that particular year. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until rain fell upon them from the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. Evidently, the Gibeonites, not being Israelis, kept the bodies on display longer than just one day. And so Rizpah is out there trying to keep the bodies from being predated by the birds of the air. Verse number 11, When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines killed Saul at Gilboa. And he brought up from there the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who were hanged, and they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin at Zelah, in the tomb of Kish's father, and they did all that the king commanded, and after that God responded to the plea from the land. So David hears about how Saul's concubine is grieving and having to keep the birds of prey away, or the birds of the scavenger birds away, and he intervenes. And basically, I think, must have told the Gibeonites, you need to release those bodies. They need to be buried properly now. You've had your vengeance for what happened to you from this family. It's now time to move on. And so apparently at this time is when he gathered the bones of his best friend Jonathan and Saul and the other sons of Saul from Jabesh-Gilead, brought them to Benjamin, put them in the family tomb, as well as the body parts, the bones that were left of these that had been executed for their role in the atrocities against the Gibeonites. And so now David is able to move forward, having taken care of these things, and the reign begins once again, and the Israeli people see the famine broken. So that takes care of all of that business with the two different lines of King Saul's remaining family. When we come back tomorrow, we're going to jump ahead to the beginning of David's days of trouble. So let's get ourselves ready to see David break God's heart as well as our own.